كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم. الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون. قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, "My Lord, show me how you revive the dead," he said, "Do you not believe?" He said, "Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest." He said, "Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise." Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. After nearly 5 months, the Secretary General of the Lebanese Resistance Movement, Hezbollah, has finally had a long-awaited for and proper funeral procession in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. His body on display next to his deputy, Hashem Safieddine, both martyred in September and October of last year, respectively, by the Zionist U.S. war machine. As thousands of people have flown into Beirut to join tens of thousands to pay tribute to a man who led Hezbollah for over three decades. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah strove to preserve the integrity and territory of Lebanon, to protect Palestinians against Zionist occupation and aggression, and even protected Syria from foreign-backed terrorism. His life and legacy is what we'll be discussing in tonight's installment of your Spotlight. And now for our guests. Joining us is Batul Sobeti, activist and political analyst, joining us from from London. And Saeed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political analyst, also joining us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess, Batul, we'll start with you. Condolences to you for the passing of Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, for Sayed Hashim Safieddine. Your initial thoughts on the life and legacy of Sayed Hassan Nasrallah.
Right. He was a leader who ultimately had a deep love and connection in the hearts of the masses, even before their minds. He penetrated their hearts. The people have maintained the same momentum, the same strength, enthusiasm, and love over quite a long period of time, from since the early 1990s until 2024. His love has never diminished, nor has his popularity amongst his followers and supporters. On the contrary, his influence has only grown. It's expanded, it's spread, until it's now reached all corners of the world, making him ultimately a legendary symbol and an icon in thought, just as he was in the hearts of many. Sayed Nasrallah was destined to exist in a region that is filled with deception, where political action was not genuine, but merely the reception of orders from external forces. Yet he stood as the true model, confronting the great but unjust and malevolent powers that dominate. And so his path became a beacon for all liberation movements worldwide, imposing itself on the political landscape of the region and setting a standard that ultimately others find difficult to reach. Sayed Nasrallah was a man who elevated and advanced everything around him. Under him, Lebanon became the focus of global attention. And everyone, I mean everyone, benefited from his contributions. His influence was not only limited to his supporters alone. Even his enemies and his adversaries began to adopt his methods of work, his political maneuvering, seeking to refine their performance and to elevate their political actions. And so due to his immense influence, it was expected that inevitably he would be met with an equal counterforce. If you want to know the value of something, look at what's standing in the way of it. In this case, it was 84 tons of explosives on his body.
Thank you, Batul. Sayed Mohsen Abbas, welcome to the program. Good to have you join us. Our condolences to you once again for Sayed Hassan Nasrallah and Sayed Hashim Safieddine's passing. Your initial thoughts on the late Hezbollah leader's legacy and the charismatic persona that's going to stay with us for years ahead.
Yes, my condolences to all of humanity, because Sayed Nasrallah was not just for the Lebanese people. He wasn't just a figure who stood for the Hezbollah movement. He It's someone who I think who transcends, all of these boundaries and barriers. In the end, what really shines for me is that virtually every one of the resistance axis leaders, you'll note one thing that they have in common. They have a prophetic virtue ethics. You know, you look at Sheikh Zakzaki, who was there today, you look at Sayyid Khamenei, you look at any of the leaders, name any of them that are prominent, even within the movement of the Houthis, and you will see this one shining value which comes out, which is their virtues, is their honor, their sacrifice, their loyalty, their sense of love and respect. But also, they then embody and represent role models which actually people don't just follow as political leaders, but in reality, they follow them as good human beings. So whether you're Muslim or non-Muslim, if you really get beyond the Israeli Hasbara, which is obviously widespread across the world, what you'll find is a man who represents the most wholesome of personalities, of men. And I think that's the big takeaway. And that's why you can't destroy a man like Sayyid Nasrallah. You can't kill him because he's an institution in his own right now. And he's as a martyr, you know, we Muslims, obviously we know very well that martyrs don't die. And so all that's happened is through this martyrdom is that Israelis have really really put a nail in their coffin, which is very, very secure. I mean, the reality of the matter is that Israel now, if you look at what they've done, yes, okay, you've killed Sayyid Safaddin, you've killed Sayyid Nasrallah, but what have you bought in return? You've bought $67 billion of loss, an Eilat port, which is bankrupt, hundreds of thousands displaced. You've bought yourself a defeat at the hands of a barely trained Palestinian resistance, and you've got a million or so Israelis who have now done an exodus. And at the end, what they achieved is a labeling of them as terrorists on a level which has never been seen before. You know, the terrorism they did in terms of the pagers that they detonated amongst the Lebanese civilian population, that has not gone from their memory. But all of this is thanks, I think, very much to the steadfastness of Sayyid Nasrallah, his ability to convert Hezbollah from being simply a little military set of cells, operating in a kind of resistance mode, which also ultimately defeated a 15-year Israeli occupation, to actually a force which not only provided social services, medical services, served Christian, Muslim, whoever, which actually gave the Lebanese a sense of, protection and safety. But he's also fought for the freedom of the Syrians, sadly, something which hasn't lasted. But we can't forget that the levels of victories which Sayyid Nasrallah has overseen are too innumerable to mention within one program. But I'll try and get back to more of them, perhaps in later questions.
Right. And Batul, would you like to weigh in on that? How do you see Sayyid Hassan's impact on not just Lebanese, but also regional resistance over the past 30 plus years?
Yes, absolutely. In terms of Lebanon and the region, so he spared the country of Lebanon from civil war by preventing it and refusing to basically be dragged into strife. He raised the level of revolutionary movements as they strove to match him. He provided all the parties' expertise to the surrounding resistance movements in the region with boundless generosity. There was selflessness. He prioritized them, even if they disagreed with him. There was an exchange of expertise, generosity in giving. So Sayyid Nasrallah ultimately elevated Lebanon to another level as well. Sayyid Nasrallah kept the global powers on edge. They were constantly concerned. The weight of the resistance necessitated an equivalent counterweight from the West. So they mobilized all of their machinery to attack the resistance throughout these years, and the counterweights were not in equal measure. And so that ultimately allowed them to advance. We saw how the colonial forces moved to defend their pet project Israel, the occupation entity. We saw how Sayyid Nasrallah turned the previously prevailing surrender in the region prior to 1982, when the resistance was formed, into an arena of active confrontation that effectively kicked the Zionists out in 2000 and liberated the country. There had been some confrontations prior to 1982, but ultimately he came and he gave it an authentic and effective, a sincere and a significantly more serious dimension. Sayyid awakened the consciousness of the nation and the religious path that was asleep. Instead, he activated the religious path of sacrifice. For this reason, he, you know, constantly focused on the topic of Imam Hussein and martyrdom within his speeches, you know, considering the Imam to be a pioneer of liberation movements and the ultimate model who sacrificed himself for the survival and for the salvation and the revival of the nation. So he, Sayyid Nasrallah, revived this through his martyrdom. And we're seeing that the nation has ultimately been revived through the slogans that he raised during his lifetime, which after his death has now been turned into a kind of flood. It's been turned into a volcano. For when a leader sacrifices himself, that's when the concepts transform into life and movement within the people. So what's happened is you've got a quantity of people who have now turned into mass quality. And the taxation for this transformation process is ultimately the blood.
Thank you. And Sayyid, say as a leadership, how do you see his persona, which obviously shined through his leadership, how do you see it impact, having impacted over the years, the spiritual and political trajectory of not just Hezbollah, but also the military strength of the Lebanese resistance movement?
Well, of course, Lebanon is very cosmopolitan. There are Christians, Druze, and there are Sunni Muslims. So it's a very diverse society. And I think one of the things that's underestimated is how Sayyid Nasrallah managed to navigate this entire cosmopolitan environment with a spiritual character and with a religious identity still intact. And yet he's managed to win friends and create unity and keep that country as together as possible, because don't forget, before the emergence of Hezbollah and before Israel had occupied that land, there had been an absolutely devastating war, a vicious internal civil war. So getting Lebanon not to spiral back into that has been a major achievement by Sayyid Nasrallah, by basically, even though he was politically, as a party, were powerful and strong and were dominant, really, but he didn't impose that domination. He tried to work in a fraternal way with all the forces, and he's also offered Hezbollah sacrifices of his men for the sake of Lebanon, where others haven't stood up. Let's face it, the Lebanese army itself has done next to nothing, or had to do next to nothing, because Hezbollah have done that. And all of this, ultimately, when you talk about his personality, this man, rather like all the other Hezbollah warriors, and even the ones before him, even stretching back as far as Abbas Mousavi or Sayyid Moussa Sadr, all of these leaders, if you look within the Lebanon fraternity, Imad Mughniyeh, they were all forged in the crucible of conflict. They were forged in wars, sieges, assassination attempts, relentless psyops. Sayyid Nasrallah, more so than anybody, you know, he survived so many assassination attempts, and he had to live this life of basically a kind of a warrior in constant daily recognition that he could be killed at any time. But he embraced that. He sacrificed his own son as well during the course of this process. And he was a real living example for the Lebanese people. And let's face it, across the Muslim world, the temptation for Muslims to wilt and to become neoliberal, to go for the materialist line, to buy into the American so-called dream, to do what the Saudis and to do what the Kuwaitis and all the other Khaliji Arabs have been doing for decades now, basically selling their souls to the devil, siphoning off the money of their nations, selling out their people, selling off their dignity, serving in humiliation to an Anglo-Zionist empire, trying to normalize with Israel. You see, Sayyid Nasrallah gave the Arabs pride. I say the Arabs because, of course, prior to this, there'd been no victory by any Arab army against Israel. It's Sayyid Nasrallah and the victories of 2000 and 2006, which really decimated Israeli invincibility. And he's continued to do that because in this particular round, Sayyid Nasrallah's tactics and the training of his army has led to basically IDF again, or the IOF, I should call it, being again humiliated. They couldn't move virtually, you know, a matter of meters or inches into the territory of Lebanon beyond what has allowed them to. They basically were unable to achieve any of their objectives of reoccupying Lebanon, all because of, you know, the organization, the military organization, which was there, which was done under the auspices of Sayyid Nasrallah. The political organization held Lebanon together. And the reality of the matter is, in this last war, I don't think that Israel would have achieved even the ceasefire that they begged, basically, to get going, had it not been for the fact that they were bombing civilians, and also civilians who weren't necessarily Hezbollah civilians. So they were killing people who were Christians and others in order to make them tell Hezbollah, beg Hezbollah to stop their missile attacks on Tel Aviv. And what we saw in this last war was nowhere is safe in Israel, just as Sayyid Nasrallah promised. If you looked carefully before Israel finally had to bend to the truce, was basically that Hezbollah were violating, maybe 400 or 500 missiles were violating Tel Aviv, Jaffa, Haifa. They were violating these territories constantly. So all I saw during my lifetime of watching Sayyid Nasrallah was a man who was victorious on a personal level in the terms of his people and in terms of the oppressed in the region. And for that, one has to just constantly laud the leadership and the power and the kind of pride which is reinstilled within all the oppressed in that region.
Thank you, Sayyid. And Batul, why was the occupation so threatened by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, where, to Sayyid's point, they tried so many times over the years to assassinate him, where they leveled an entire city block in Dahiya in late September for his martyrdom?
Right. Ultimately, because the goal of political action is to reach the public and to turn objectives into a movement. With Sayyid Nasrallah, we saw truth in an era of deception. We saw truth in the sense of real action, truth in the sense of ideology and methodology. This led to achievements that were building up. Sayyid Nasrallah created an undefeatable party, regardless of the battles. Defeat is merely the feeling of being defeated, but he led the transformation, activating the immense latent heritage in people's beliefs into movement, you know, in the same way that Imam Khomeini did this through the Islamic Revolution in Iran. So this heritage was not created by Sayyid Nasrallah, but his role was in its activation. He created a party that ultimately refined souls, changed mindsets. He elevated the level of political engagement domestically. Everyone sought to catch up with him and to emulate him. And ultimately, the goal of political parties is to reach the public with their ideas. You know, they strive through speeches, through publications, through seminars, to influence, to elevate people's awareness to a certain level. And Sayyid Nasrallah, ultimately, we see this with his blood. We see the power of Sayyid Nasrallah when he was alive through his blood. We see today how his blood has transformed the nation from this mass quantity of people into quality. And the blood is the necessary price to pay for this transformation. It's the taxation of this process. And the crowds that we saw today, you know, this nation that we saw today, they would have come out in their masses also if they knew that Sayyid Nasrallah was going to be with them speaking in public. It's not the case that because he's been killed that they're coming out. No, if he was actually coming out to meet the people and to greet them, they would have come out in their hundreds of thousands as well. And so this crowd that we saw today, it cannot be subdued under any circumstances. That nation will reach its goals because it follows this path, it possesses this vision, it carries the spirit. Today we're at a stage where the resistance party's body has advanced beyond its leadership. And we see that the masses who rally behind the resistance have advanced even beyond the party's body after deeply internalizing its principles. The bloodshed has turned their beliefs, the beliefs of the masses, into real momentum. So through turning the Secretary General into a martyr, the party's body has become stronger and more driven than its leadership, and its public have become more driven than the party's body. And for this reason, you see that the resistance, without even giving orders, it relied on the masses to go to the south of Lebanon, to go to the border, to confront the Israeli tanks at zero distance, and to ultimately liberate the villages of the south with their bare flesh. Mm. In the face of that, what is the enemy able to do?
And Sayed, what did we learn today from this epic turnout for the funeral procession of Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, of Sayed Hashem Saifuddin in Beirut and elsewhere, in Iran, in Iraq, even in Kuwait, in Bahrain, in Yemen, all over the world, there are simultaneous processions that took place today. And what did we learn from these?
Well, what we learned is there is popular support for Hezbollah, and we learned that Hezbollah is confident, it's strong, and it's powerful. It remains intact, you know, even in spite of all the hasbara that they're trying to pump out to say how weakened Hezbollah is and how they're not able to be politically as effective. All of that is washed away with this one gathering. What you've seen is defiance, unity, you've seen resilience, and you can see the determination of the General Secretary named Qasim in his vows to fight on, and his commitment to the resistance, even until martyrdom for himself as well. And of course, Ayatollah Khamenei, we also saw the support coming from that that front. The resistance will continue, he said. Of course, people like Sheikh Zakzaki I mentioned, but other leaders, lots of the IRGC and the Islamic Republic's leaders were there, and other dignitaries who all hold Sayyid Nasrallah in great esteem have all shown, and the Yemenis, not least of all the Yemenis, they've shown that actually they are also resilient and united and in defiance to American hegemony. Of course, the Americans are trying to embed themselves in Lebanon, but they're going to find that, I think, that they are going to fail in their efforts to divide and to destroy Lebanon from within, because that's the main tactic that Israel has now got. They can't defeat the Hezbollah movement or the Lebanese people militarily. They've seen that. So their next effort now is all invested in trying to divide and destroy internally. And that's, I think, where Hezbollah's main concentration has been to defend. But on the borders, don't forget, we've got Daesh, the ISIS fraternity, all the Anglo-Zionist-backed Julani types, they're now trying to hem in Hezbollah from one side. And of course, the Israelis, who are so depleted, they can't face Hezbollah in any effective way. They may try to get this kind of ragtag organization in Syria to somehow try to give Hezbollah problems as well. But I think that they're going to find it's a very hard nut to crack. And I guess all we can do is that the legacy of Sayyid Nasrallah would be best served by seeing the complete liberation of Lebanon, all of South Lebanon, and the liberation of Palestine, because he's a Shia leader. And the Hasbara and the Takfiris generally try to pump out this division between Shia and Sunni. But Sayyid Nasrallah is a fantastic example of how a Shia dies for the Sunnis of Palestine. That in itself is another total destruction that he's caused. Even in his death, he's caused the destruction of the Western and Israeli plans.
Time has gotten the better of us. I want to thank you both for joining us on the program, and stay safe to the both of you. Batul Subeiti, activist and political analyst there, and also Sayed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political analyst, both joining us from London. And this brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your UP Spotlight program. Thank you for joining us, and bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on iranradio.ir with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program again.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, we have talked about many issues of jurisprudential nature based on the fatwas, you know, issued by Ayatollah Khamenei so far, Sheikh Javid.
Sure.
And let's actually delve into some of the fundamental questions regarding taqlid, because that's usually appears at the beginning of every risala you open up, right?
Right.
So let's start with the very basic idea or concept of taqlid. What is taqlid?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, taqlid is to follow mujtahid.
Mm.
There is nothing ambiguous about it, okay?
Yes.
And it's not good to make it very much complicated for our audience, mm-hmm. okay? The simple definition we can give about taqlid is to follow a mujtahid. Mm-hmm. Yes, if you act according to a mujtahid's fatwa or whatever you call verdict, that's enough, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's what we call taqlid, okay?
Yes.
We are not going to look into the literal meaning of taqlid, okay?
Right.
Taqlid in its literal meaning has a different meaning, okay? Which we do not mean when we talk about taqlid, okay? We talk about taqlid in its technical or scientific or jurisprudential context.
Yes. You know, Sheikh Javid, a long time ago, we've seen when a lot of these books, in fact, have been translated from Arabic and Persian, and these Muslims-dominated areas, basically, into the Western world and their books and the languages.
Yeah.
And I've seen some blatant mistakes, basically. It was so obvious, it was so vivid that you could see that this is a false and a blunder. They have translated taqlid into copying, imitation, and the like,
right.
Which is totally wrong. We all know, right?
Yeah.
And following maybe is, you know, a word which is closest in equivalent,
yes.
right, to the word taqlid in Arabic, of course.
Yeah.
Would you talk about the translation of taqlid? Because you also use the word or the term following.
Yeah.
By taqlid, obviously, we don't mean that you imitate someone else
yeah.
or you copy someone else, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And what we mean is mostly limited to basically the jurisprudential verdicts, as you mentioned, right?
Yes. So, as you rightly mentioned, the word mimic or imitate is not
the right word.
Is not the right word.
Yes.
It's not appropriate to use these words when we talk about taqlid. Taqlid has actually a philosophy,
yes.
a reason which is very clear and very vivid. When we follow a mujtahid, we follow because we have no knowledge or no expertise, no technical awareness
yes.
about the practical laws of Islam. So it's only the mujtahid or the faqih who is an expert of Islamic law, and of course he is the one who should be who advises about religious issues, about jurisprudential issues, and we should listen to his advice.
Exactly.
Okay? So that's what taqlid actually means.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on Iran Radio .ir. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, 'cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program and just with our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the major concepts of jurisprudence, I mean taqlid. Well, based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei, Sheikh Javid, if we don't actually, follow a mujtahid or a religious authority, is there any other way planned out or devised by the religion for us? Is it available to a mukallaf or a duty-bound to practice some of the rituals in Islam?
Well, to be honest, taqlid is the easiest way, to practice Islam and to practice religion.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's not the only way, mm-hmm. Because there are other ways to practice Islam.
Yeah.
So, taqlid is one of them, and of course, a person who engages in jurisprudential studies and finally becomes a mujtahid himself,
mm-hmm.
he does not need to follow another person.
Yes.
He's not a muqallid,
right.
And he's someone who acts upon his own understanding, upon according to his own knowledge and wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, of course, he's not supposed to act according to his own personal opinion.
Right.
He acts according to what he understands from the religious sources. Okay, any topic that he might have discovered or explored, he acts according to what he has understood.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there is also another way,
mm-hmm.
and that's called ihtiyat. Okay,
right.
Ihtiyat means to, to see the different angles and all the dimensions,
mm-hmm.
and see which is more precautionary. Okay, and that's very difficult. Ihtiyat means, for example, I give you an example.
Right.
If happen to miss your prayer during a journey, and then you come back home, mm-hmm. and again you miss your prayer at home when you arrive in your own hometown.
I see.
Now, which prayer are you supposed to offer? Are you supposed to offer the shortened form of prayer because you did not offer your prayer during the journey?
Mm-hmm.
Or you have to offer the full prayer, the complete prayer? According to ihtiyat, okay, you have to observe both full and qasr prayer.
Mm-hmm.
That's what precaution ihtiyat means, okay?
Yes.
Because you missed the prayer during the journey and also when you arrived at home. But if you do not act according to ihtiyat and you simply follow a mujtahid, the mujtahid will tell you, mm-hmm. that, okay, if you offer the prayer in full, that's enough.
I see.
You're not going to exercise precaution and offer the same prayer, both as shortened form as well as full form.
That's why you meant taqlid is the easiest way, actually.
That's why I say that taqlid is the easiest way, because you trust the mujtahid,
uh-huh.
who is knowledgeable, who is wise,
yes.
and who has the... the necessary faculty and the capability to infer Islamic laws from its sources, i.e. mm-hmm. the Quran and the Sunnah and also the other religious sources.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. I have a relevant question, but we have to actually postpone it to after the break. Stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina wa Nabiyina Muhammadin wa Ali.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Before the break, Sheikh Javid, when you were talking about, taqlid being the easiest way of practicing Islam, you mentioned within your speech there are other ways, than taqlid. What are those ways? One of them you mentioned, ihtiyat, right?
One of them is to exercise precaution.
Yes.
Okay, ihtiyat is the most difficult way to
practice
Islam.
Which is based on logic, I guess, right?
Yeah, it is logic, yes. it's the,
like your logic or your precaution, as you mentioned.
Yeah, precaution.
Or your intellect tells you, for example, to, as you mentioned in your example, like to have to offer prayers for both of, for example, the missed prayers, whether the shortened one or the complete form,
yes.
Right? So this is what the logic tells you.
The logic.
To cover both.
Yes.
At least one of them is going to be accepted,
yeah,
right,
one
by
of
God.
Them. Yeah, of course.
So, but taqlid, as you mentioned, you trust the mujtahid or a learned, in
your
fact,
mind.
Or the most learned religious the scholar, learned. And then you follow that particular individual.
Yes.
But what are the other ways? Are there
the
any?
The other way is to become a mujtahid yourself.
I see.
You know, because we have many mujtahid here and there, and especially in Islamic seminaries, and those mujtahids are not following any other scholars. Okay, they act according to their own inferences, according to their own deductions,
knowledge, yes.
Okay, according to their own conclusions.
Yes,
and that's also very difficult, because to become a mujtahid, it will take you, let's say, 20 years, if not more.
Yes.
To become a mujtahid, and at the end of the day, you will cease to practice or follow another mujtahid. You will follow your own opinion concerning religious issues.
Yes.
So that's the second way, and of course, the easiest way, as I said, is taqlid.
I see. Okay. I'm sure that when you talk about taqlid or following a religious scholar. You mean that in jurisprudential issues, right?
Yeah.
And in some of the, issues and problems you have related to the rituals, but not everything, not the tenets, not the pillars of Islam, right?
Yes.
Is that correct?
You are right. Of course, the religious authorities have indicated in the beginning of their risala that it is not permissible to follow Islam in regards to the tenets and principles of faith, and it's necessary to follow. It's necessary to believe in the principles of faith based on your own insight and your own understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it is necessary that you develop this understanding over time. Of course, as a child, you might not have that understanding. But as you grow up and you consider and you study everything, then you will begin to understand that there should be one God.
Yes.
And that one God should be just.
Mm-hmm.
And then he should send a prophet. And then there should be some people as imams, infallible imams.
Yes.
Who should, after the prophet, guide the humanity with their teachings.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, on iranradio.ir with me, Muhammad Javad, the host of this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim Mannan Kareem Salam Aleem Majam Ilaha Illah Ghaffar Jameel Wahhab Latif Tawwab Samee' Basir Ilaha Illah وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture.
Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
It is time for the Arabs to prove to the Zionist regime that the lessons of history have been learned and will never be repeated. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, I've read 25 books on the Middle East. Jared Kushner, U.S. President Donald Trump's son-in-law, said in a 2020 interview, such intellectual bravado wouldn't matter if it weren't for the fact that Kushner served as the president's West Asia region advisor and was essentially the main architect of Trump's policies in the West Asia region. It goes without saying that Trump's policies in the region were a failure and, in fact, fueled the events that followed his departure, leading to the genocidal war in Gaza. Trump's successor didn't fare any better, as the Joe Biden administration largely adhered to Trump's major mistakes and ultimately sustained the Israeli regime genocide, which killed and wounded, per the latest estimates, over 160,000. Biden, too, proved to be a reader, although, unlike Kushner, he didn't publicly brag about his intellectual prowess. On November 29, a photo emerged of him holding a book by Palestinian historian Rachid Khalidi entitled The Hundred Years' War on Palestine, a history of settler colonialism and resistance, 1917 to 2017. Though American leaders and officials claim to base their decisions on a thorough understanding of the complexity of the West Asia region, they are repeating the same historical mistakes over and over again. Trump's repeated comments about taking ownership of Gaza, displacing its population, turning their destroyed homeland into real estate opportunities, and threatening them with hell, should they not follow his diktats, express more than callousness. They also reflect ignorance. Trump is using such language based on the misguided idea that these threats would allow him to restore political leverage, which Washington lost over the course of 15 months of blind support for the Zionist regime genocide in Gaza. No rational thinker in the West Asia region or beyond would actually imagine a scenario in which Palestinians are leaving en masse due to Trump's threats. They have refused to do so after dropping of over 85,000 tons of mostly U.S.-supplied explosives that nearly destroyed all of Gaza. Empty threats will certainly not change that. Even though the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his extremist government took advantage of Trump's words to repair, however, temporarily, their struggling coalition turning Trump's supposed new doctrine on Gaza into reality is an impossible feat. The Zionist regime has, in fact, tried to create the circumstances that would lead, in the words of Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, to the voluntary migration of Palestinians out of Gaza. On January 27th, the opposite was achieved, as nearly a million displaced Palestinians who were driven to southern Gaza began their awe-inspiring march to the north. It behooves the U.S. administration to stop discounting history, as any wrong move or policy could lead to disastrous outcomes. Historically, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians has been the main objective of all Zionist policies. Even before the establishment of the fabricated regime of Israel over the ruins of historic Palestine in 1948, the Nakba, or the catastrophic destruction of the Palestinian homeland, leading to the depopulation of the majority of the country's Palestinian inhabitants. Aside from the immorality of that act, the pain of which continues to be felt by generations of Palestinian refugees, the event was catastrophic to the West Asia region as well. Aside from millions of refugees displaced in Palestine itself, millions more live in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, other parts of the West Asia region, and around the world. Currently, there are nearly 6 million registered Palestinian refugees, according to the UN Agency for Palestine, UNRWA, though a large number of refugees remain unaccounted for. That political earthquake of 76 years ago remains one of the most decisive events that shaped and continues to shape the West Asia to this day. Its reversal will remain elusive unless justice finally prevails in Palestine. Justice that is dictated by international and humanitarian laws, not impulsive statements from American officials. Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria were the Arab countries that hosted most Palestinian refugees and whose political dynamics as well as conflicts were shaped by the mass displacement of Palestinians. Palestinian groups became part of the political fabric of these societies, sometimes becoming involved in internal struggles and sometimes used to balance pre-existing demographic conflicts. Hardly a major event in the West Asia region didn't involve Palestinians, or the price of which was not disproportionately shouldered by Palestinians. Anyone who knows the fundamentals of modern West Asian politics ought to know this. One can only imagine that would happen if 2.2 million Palestinian refugees were pushed into Jordan, Egypt, and other Arab countries per Trump's proposal. It would arguably be the most earth-shattering event in the region since the Nakba. No Arab government can possibly entertain such a scenario under any circumstance. While the prospects of another Gaza Nakba were born dead, the real fear is the fact that nearly 50,000 Palestinians have already been internally displaced in the West Bank. This ongoing ethnic cleansing is no less dangerous than the U.S. Zionist designs in Gaza. The uniform U.S. policy on Palestine, which continues to be led by the extremely dangerous policies of the politically bankrupt government of child killer Netanyahu, is unifying the Arabs, Muslims, once again, around a common cause. If the Americans insist on ignoring history, the Arabs and Muslims know their history very well. It is time for them to prove to the Zionist regime that the lessons of history have been learned and will never be repeated.
Thank you. Desde el corazón de Asia Occidental, la hora de Irán te sumerge en el mundo persa. Conocerás su cultura y posición en el mundo.
Hola, queridos oyentes. Bienvenidos a una nueva emisión de La Hora de Irán. Es un placer estar con ustedes. Como siempre, agradecemos a todos los que nos siguen en cada programa y a quienes se unen por primera vez. Entonces, no se despeguen de la radio. Les recordamos que pueden participar y enviarnos sus comentarios y mensajes a través de nuestro sitio iranradio.ir. Empezamos el programa con una conversación.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته En el nombre de Dios, el misericordioso, el clemente, me refugio en Dios del maldito Satanás. La paz y la bendición de Dios sea con los siervos santos justos de Dios. Hola, hola, amigos de América Latina, amigos y hermanos de habla hispana. Te saluda tu fiel servidor, Eduardo Castillo Ortiz. Hoy tenemos un programa muy especial, muy hermoso y sobre todo muy controversial. Y como siempre, tenemos la grata presencia de nuestro amigo, de nuestro hermano, Abel Salinas Vargas. Hola Abel, ¿cómo te encuentras?
Hola, salam aleikum, ¿cómo está querido hermano, amigo, compañero? Muy feliz de estar aquí en el programa para compartir muchas controversias, muchos conocimientos, para compartir experiencias, para tocar temas importantes que puedan servir a nuestros oyentes y también ellos puedan compartir sus conocimientos, también ellos puedan ponerse a pensar un poco sobre el tema que vamos a hablar. Quizás no podamos tener esa comunicación directa y poder conversar, pero ellos podrán sacar sus conclusiones a los temas que vamos a tratar. Para mí es un gusto estar aquí nuevamente. Bueno, estoy a las órdenes. Adelante.